36. It rained again in the night and in the morning. When I looked out of the window, the sun was up and clouds of purple vapour appeared to be peeling off the flank of Mount Liebler. At 10, Rolf and I went over to look for Limpy. A message had come from Arcady, 3 weeks overdue, to expect him on the mail plane. It was important, repeat, very important, that Limpy and Titus were available. The medicinal smell from eucalyptus fires drifted across the valley. The dog howled at our approach. People were drying their blankets. "Limpy," Rolf called, and a faint voice echoed from a ramshackle caravan somewhere uphill.
"So that's where they are," he said.
The caravan had been optimistically painted with the words Recreation Centre. It contained a wobbly ping-pong table minus the net, which was covered with a film of red dust. The three grand old men were sitting on the floor, Limpy, Alex and Joshua, in hats. Limpy had on a Stetson, Joshua, a Yankee baseball cap, and Alex wore a magnificent frayed-out bushwhacker.
"Is Titus out at the bar?" Rolf asked.
"Sure he's there," said Limpy.
"He's not going anywhere."
"Nah,"
he shook his head.
"Stay right there."
"How do you know?"
Rolf asked.
"I know," said Limpy,
and brought the conversation to an end. Rolf told me earlier that Alex owned one of the pearl oyster shell pendants from the Timor Sea, which had been traded across Australia from time immemorial. They were used in rain-making ceremonies. Alex's had plainly done its work for this year. He then surprised us by plunging his hand between the buttons of the velvet coat and pulled out the pendant on the end of a string. It was engraved with a zigzag meander pattern, rubbed with red ochre. It must have been dangling between his legs. Superficially, these pendants resemble a churinga, but, as far as strangers are concerned, they are not necessarily secret.
"So where does he come from?" I asked, pointing at the shell.
"Broom,"
said Alex, definitely. He drew his forefinger across the dusty ping-pong table and rattled off all the stops across the Gibson Desert, between Cullen and Broom.
"Okay," I said, "you get the pearl shells from Broom. What do you send back?"
He hesitated and then drew in the dust an elongated oval.
"Bored,"
he said.
"Churinga?" I asked.
He nodded.
"Sacred business? Songs and all?"
He nodded again.
"That," I said to Rolf as we walked away, "is very interesting."
The song still remains, which names the land over which it sings. Martin Heidegger, what a poet's for. Before coming to Australia, I'd often talk about the song lines, and people would be inevitably reminded of something else, like the ley lines, they'd say, referring to ancient stone circles, menhirs and graveyards, which are laid out in lines across Britain. They are of great antiquity, but are visible only to those with eyes to see. Sinologists were reminded of the dragon lines of Feng Shui, or traditional Chinese geomancy, and when I spoke to a Finnish journalist, he said the Lapps had singing stones, which were also arranged in lines. To some, the song lines were like the art of memory in reverse. In Francis Yates' wonderful book, one learned how classical orators, from Cicero and earlier, would construct memory palaces, fastening sections of their speech onto imaginary architectural features, and then, after working their way round every architrave and pillar, could memorize colossal lengths of speech. The features were known as loci, or places. But in Australia, the loci were not a mental construction, but had existed forever as events of the dream time. Other friends were reminded of the Nazca lines, which are etched into the meringue-like surface of the central Peruvian desert, and are indeed some kind of totemic map. We once spent a hilarious week with their self-appointed guardian, Maria Reich. One morning, I went with her to see the most spectacular of all the lines, which was only visible at sunrise. I carried her photographic equipment up a steep hill of dust and stones, while Maria, in her 70s, strode ahead. I was horrified to watch her roll straight past me to the bottom. I expected broken bones, but she laughed. My father used to say that once you start to roll, you must keep on rolling.
No,
These were not the comparisons I was looking for, not at this stage. I was beyond that. Trade means friendship and cooperation, and for the Aboriginal, the principal object of trade was song. Song, therefore, brought peace. Yet I felt the songlines were not necessarily an Australian phenomenon, but universal, that they were the means by which man marked out his territory and so organized his social life. All other successive systems were variants, or perversions, of this original model. The main songlines in Australia appear to enter the country from the north or the northwest, from across the Timor Sea or the Torres Strait, and from there weave their way southwards across the continent. One has the impression that they represent the roots of the first Australians, and that they have come from somewhere else. How long ago? 50,000 years? 80 or 100,000 years? The dates are insignificant compared to those from African prehistory. And here I must take a leap into faith, into regions I would not expect anyone to follow. I have a vision of the songlines stretching across the continents and ages, that wherever men have trodden, they have left a trail of song, of which we may now and then catch an echo, and that these trails must reach back in time and space to an isolated pocket in the African savannah, where the first man, opening his mouth in defiance of the terrors that surrounded him, shouted the opening stanza of the world song, "I am."